He's not, he goes to there, that's gone. Him and God comes in.
Yes.
The thing about from top to bottom, actually, he goes to top note faster, higher frequency, and therefore more original moment.
You
can just remember that you take your surface in water. When the wind first blows on water, it ripples it. So the first motion on the water is a high frequency, short wave.
Yes. On those undulations,
gravity ripples are still present. And it continues to go down like this. On the wave in the third order, you have this wave in the second order. And the higher frequencies of the third superimpose on that one. So you can build your scale like that. But each one, you're going to get the top, it's low. And then the next frequency is T or C below it. And the next one is R. And the next one is the saw, which I'm going to go down. So continuously, so that really the scale descended is contained within the motion of one substance. This you can see very easily if you watch a body of water moving. The highly complex nature of the motion on it. Now, if we talk reasonably, we're talking about formal relation. The ratio of one to the other. How many beats the second in the first, how many in the second, and so on. And you're talking reasonably. But that may or may not have an application. Actually, this diagram has an application. The one you mentioned may or may not. Mm-hmm. You might be able to extend it to make it have one. But just because the system is self-defined does not mean that it has application.
No.
Because if that was so, then every self-consistent philosophy would be true. And what we know about philosophies is that you can construct them on the basis of also, as if anything whatever was so. You could make a rational philosophy as if everybody had a triangular head. And you could then work how many people could lie in a bed and in what positions to leave the least exposed space. That never means you can find those people with triangular heads. So when you make a closed system, like, say, Leibniz's philosophy of Samson, it doesn't follow that that thing actually corresponds with being, absolutely. So although self-consistency is essential for unity, it doesn't follow that you've got self-consistency, you have correspondence with reality.
What I was thinking about at the time that I started looking at the scales was the idea that different levels, say from the mineral world right up to the human being, must be kept in being by resonance factors.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I started to study music as something you could equate with resonance.
Yeah,
that's what I was getting at.
Yes.
So I started to.
Yeah.
Can you run
fast? No, the other two are people a taxi.
Yeah.
Oh, cool. It's a good exercise, of course, to try to work out the relation between things, isn't that right?
Well, trying to see a little factor.
Hmm. But you see, in a diagram like this, when we've drawn the first ripple, we have to bend this first line representing the circle. So, really, we should rub the first one out. Here's the first one. We'll rub that one out and draw this. Now the wind continues to blow. And over time builds up another wave. So we rub that one out and we do this. That's got three elements, isn't it?
Yes.
Now we've got to take a structure in which we're going to wrap another one on like this. And then like this. Are you going to describe each one of those as a different order of energy in that case?
I'm sure that they're all different frequencies,
therefore different orders of energy.
And yet there is only one substance there, vibrating in this highly complex way.
Yes.
So the different orders of energy. Yes. Do not in fact introduce a concept of plurality from discrete beings. These beings are not separated out.
No.
They're really highly complex motions of a non-differentiated substance. That non-differentiated, which represents initially by a straight line, is the seamless garment of Christ.
Yes.
And that guarantees that you can't really break out of relation. Because whatever you do, you're only bending that seamless garment.
Yes.
It is the continuity principle of the universe. So when you think you are furthest from it, as in this diagram, you're really not. All you have to do is ignore the differentiating vibrations, and you can contemplate its seamlessness immediately. Which means that heaven isn't far away.
This is
the kingdom of heaven is at hand. Yes, at the moment this light is hurting my eyes. It should have a nice shade on it.
You couldn't get it.
I'm aware of that, whilst at the same time I'm talking to you.
Yes.
Now, the sound of your voice to me when you speak is a different frequency from the light that's hitting in the eye. The voice is pleasant and the light is unpleasant. They both occur simultaneously. My continuous substance is responding to two different frequencies simultaneously. I can ignore the intensity of that light deliberately. I can deliberately give it a new significance. I can say it represents the absolute brilliance which could penetrate all possible darknesses, and deliberately give it an emotional tone that is really very nice. It's a delightful hurt that it gives me. In fact, the way it hurts me gives me evidence that I will always be free because that light exists. It shines in my darkness. And the little bit of pain it gives me reminds me that I'm not alone. I'm in relation. So I can interpret the stimulus in any way I like. And yet, in the act of interpreting it, I'm not separating the fact from another fact. The light and the sound of your voice coexist. And there's a funny noise coming from the machine over there, and there's certain elements from the carpet that are softer in the echo than those from the wall. These coexist and simultaneously impinge on my sensorium without breaking the sensorium into separate bits. If I concentrate on one of them exclusively, the others tend to lapse in intensity, and then I can believe that they're separate. But to believe that they're actually separable, severable, is to make a mistake, they are not.
Sure.
And as soon as I believe that they are severable, I believe in isolation. And if I believe in that, I can believe that I am isolated, and therefore out of relation. And as soon as I get out of relation, I go into hell.
Yeah.
Because hell is a state of unrelatedness. I believe you were discussing this question of choice recently. You came to the prison of what kind of
thing? Well, it found it very difficult to, What I found difficult to, was to separate choice from inclination.
Yeah.
I mean, after all, have you inclined towards or away from something, and what is the real difference between inclination and choice? Because I may be choosing something by a past condition or conditioning.
Well, let's see whether physically you can see the difference. Can you stand in the middle of the floor now? Straighten your legs so that your knees are braced. Lean forward without bending your knees until your waist on the balls of your feet. Keep leaning until you think your heels are coming up. Now, I want you to choose, while you're doing that, not to fall whilst physically you are inclined. What's the difference?
I can't choose not to fall. I lean forward hard enough.
What do you actually do? You continue to lean forward without choosing not to.
Well, you start to fall.
You start to fall. Now, when you think about choosing, what do you actually do inside?
I inhibit the action.
How do you do it?
By act of will.
And to what do you refer in order to make that act of will?
Well, decision not to fall, I take it.
The decision not to fall. Right. Suppose we then have inclination.
Yes.
Represent that simply as a line out of the vertical.
Yes.
As soon as we take the line out of the vertical, it starts to fall. And we're talking about a physical body.
Yes.
Your own physical body. Inside that physical body is something responding to the suggestion that you should choose not to fall. And as soon as you chose not to fall, you released energy that altered the distribution in the body of muscular stresses and tended to inhibit the inclination by feeding energies into muscles in certain places to pull you back. So you had an idea of non-fall.
Yes.
And a fact of physical inclination. Now the idea of non-fall up there was sufficient to release energy into your body to readjust the balance of forces in it, to bring you back towards the vertical.
Could it be the idea of the fact that in the past when I've fallen I've hurt myself that's pulling me back?
It may be, but it doesn't have to be. That's an empirical statement that you decide.
That was the thing that I was getting at. I mean, say I was given the choice of two coins.
Yeah.
And I said that I may choose to pick the brighter coin because as a child I'd been told that bright coins were good things to have.
Mm-hmm. You hadn't remembered the casket scene, had you? The important thing here is that when your physical body is inclined, you come under the law.
Yes.
When you refer to an idea in your mind, you are able to redistribute energies so that you escape that law, and yet all you've done is release energy from an idea.
Yes.
Now the idea is a faster frequency than the body. But as we've seen in this diagram, the idea is really a superimposition on your primary substance.
Yes.
And your body is another one of a later order. So within the body is this one.
A later order, so the body is later than me?
From the idea.
Yes.
There's the physical body, here's your ego, and here are your ideas. And they're all on the same thing, superimposed one on the other.
Yes.
The fact is that when we choose, we introduce energy from one world into another, a lower one. We have to get energy of a higher level and introduce it into energy of a lower level in order to choose. Now it's quite obvious, if a person hasn't got the idea of non-fall, he can't apply it in a falling situation. This is the meaning of know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. Free from what? Free from the law. So the more clear we become in an idea, the more we release ourselves progressively from the law. Let's take a simple case. If we show to a child two apples, firstly identical, exactly the same size, the same rosiness and so on, and say, choose one of these, the child cannot choose, because they're identical. Now if we say you can't have both, you must have one only, then it cannot choose one rather than the other, but it will choose one rather than none. We determine its choice by saying, if you don't take one now, you won't get one at all, because you're only allowed one, not two. And that determines the choice. So it's always an idea that is a higher order energy that determines a physical behavior. And this determination of a physical behavior by an idea energy is what we call choice.
So the choice is always at next highest level for stages of being.
That's right. So if we take the carpet, we say the carpet cannot choose to get up and go out. Because it hasn't got an energy of a higher order than itself. Remember what we've said about the fall into gross matter. In gross matter, all the energy is locked up in being. Just being. Whereas in a man, the energy is not locked up in being. Some of it is feeling and some of it is thinking.
Yes.
In the case of a billiard ball, an ivory billiard ball, all the energies there are being ivory. They're not being thought and being emotion, they're just being ivory.
Yes.
So if the total amount of energy in a being is involved in being, it has no energy left for something else. So if we find a man totally identified with the material situation, the pure materialist, we find a man who's entirely under the law. Because he is being material. He believes in nothing else. If he believes that he is a material entity and nothing else, then he is entirely under the law of matter. A very pathetic example, I think I mentioned to you before. A man with sufficient money to retire quietly at over 60 preferred to go for shock treatment rather than turn over his business to his two sons, because he was a materialist. And to him, to hold the business in his grasp, to dictate his policy, was existence. To turn that over to his two sons, who were 30-ish and 40, meant to him to cease to exist. And when the question was put to him, either give up your firm to your sons, or have shock treatment, he actually said, I will have shock treatment. When it said, how will the shock treatment alter the position? It will really place you in the position where your sons actually run the business, and you haven't given it up, but you can't run it. Now to him that was preferable to giving it up. You see, his life was material. He had conceived it. So if you concentrate on the gross material of your body and believe that nothing else exists, you must necessarily obey the law of matter. So the being totally concentrated on its material existence has no choice. Whatever. There are no alternatives for it. It is simply being. If we want to introduce choice into it, somehow we need it. Grind it down. This is what's happened to the rocks on the earth.
Yes.
The rocks have been ground down with glaciers and rivers and volcanic eruptions and earthquakes. And in so doing, they've been pluralized, and thus a relation has appeared between them. And you know from the fact that when particles of matter cohere, that there must be a field of energy holding them together. So we have now introduced feeling into them by separating them. So if we take the rock, say a piece of basalt or something, which is simply being itself, it has no choice. We pick it up, we throw it about. If we grind it down very, very fine, then our control of it becomes more difficult. It tends to slip. If we liquefy it again, it becomes more difficult to hold. If we turn it into a gas, it becomes more difficult to hold. So the more we are moving it away from the compaction, the more difficult it is to control from outside, and the more alternative motions there are on the inside.
Does that mean to say that you're actually raising the being of the thing?
Raising the being, you see. When the first precipitation of matter occurred, the form, from the original energy of the universe, rotating and producing finite beings, each finite being, being spirit, was free, and some of them compacted themselves. When they compacted to a certain level, they covered themselves up, put their own light out, and became stone. Now, in so becoming, they had abandoned choice. Just as if we are in the room now, we can walk about, and we can choose where we will go, because we can see. Supposing we switch the light off and on a signal, right, we all get up and rush about with no light. We bang into each other. We can't choose to avoid each other if we're running about in the dark. And so the fortuitous concourse of atoms, of old Huxley, is a blind thing where the atoms collide with each other because they can't do other. They're just rushing about and they're totally enclosed in themselves and out of relation with the others, and therefore all their contacts are contingent and external, and there is no choice in them. If we then take those rocks, and this has happened on the earth, and we grind them down to volcanic eruptions and great glacial periods and floods and so on, we reduce the mass of it to such fine proportions that it can be organized into plant form, and the plant can already choose.
Yes.
You can choose to go towards the light.
Yes.
And away from the darkness. So when we break down a solid compaction, a unity principle, the Einfassener, Burma, the grip or fastening to make one only, if we break that down, we introduce plurality, a space between, field consciousness, and a relating factor. Now, once we've broken the thing down, we have introduced a field. There's a family in the field. We now have two. Because they are family energies, originally, they are still related together. And now there's a space between them, field. And the whole being now has an awareness of a body, a duality, and a field of relation. Now, when it feels this relation, it can adjust the distance between the two physical parts. The feeling is higher than the physical fact. If we then break it down further still, we get a lot of little parts of hearing as the unity with diverse elements, and the feeling between, and highly complex formal stimuli within the being, are ideas. And by reference to these ideas and this feeling, these particles can be adjusted. They're always adjusted from above, that is from the feeling and the idea level.
Yes.
So to increase the power of choice, we have to increase sensitivity of feeling. And this itself generates plurality of ideas. These ideas are forms which are not growth material, but have the power to release energy in a growth material body. Now, if we take this to the empty, if we take it right up to the idea of the empty, then we have the idea of the free.
Yes.
People that are not taught that freedom exists don't understand what it means and cannot themselves have it. I don't know whether you read Edith Bowen's 7 Years in Solitary.
No.
There's an example of herself in a Hungarian jail where she was supposed to be incarcerated because she was a spy, and she wasn't a spy, and she knew she wasn't. When she told her jailers that in England she was allowed to move about freely, and she was given a passport to go out without having to say what it was for, and so on, they couldn't believe it, because they were not allowed to move in that way. So they hadn't got an idea of a state that could allow free movement to the individuals within it. And consequently, they could not move freely. They could only move with reference to the authorities to whom they had to report, because that was their idea level. So if we take, I know some left-wingers who actually believe that choice doesn't exist at all. They believe that the quality of the material stimulus determines your action, absolutely. And therefore choice isn't a word, it's just a sound having no meaning. And really it shouldn't be in the dictionary. Now for those people, funnily enough, it is true. They are actually determined by the idea level in which they function.
Yes.
Because they don't believe choice is possible, and that everything is determined by material stimulus, they concentrate on the material stimulus all the time. And consequently, they are determined by their mental horizon.
This is the idea of being governed by what you believe in.
Mm-hmm.
Well, as I understand it now, every higher level has a choice in relation to the lower level, all the way up the scale.
Say every higher level can determine what happens on a lower level. And this power to determine is what you mean by choice. But it's the higher looking down on the lower and introducing energy into it by referring to the higher. If we have an idea of a universal being, the idea that that is, say, one God, and this one God is the father of all of us, if we have this idea, we will have a problem of why some people don't accept it, why some people behave very badly. Now Christ doesn't do it in this way, because he said that there are other fathers. Some beings are fathered by the devil. There is one father of certain beings and another father of some other beings. Because he says, you are like your father who was alive from the beginning to a certain group of people. If we take non-dualistic philosophy as our basis, we don't have to tie ourselves down with a monistic view that there is one God of all beings. The absolute, which is not circumscribed, generates whatever it is, beings, and the energy generating those beings is the father of those beings. So if in this place beings are generating a triangle x and here square, then the father of triangular beings is here. The father of square beings is here. When Christ is in a sheep of other flock, he's saying a similar thing. Because fundamentally every being, traced back to its source, is self-generated. So that the father of the people in this room is not the same father unless we are contemplating identical forms in the beings in this room. The fact that we are bipeds, roughly, means that we have something in common, and therefore as to our biped nature we have a common father. And if we have different ideas, as father means generative power, we have as many fathers as we have different ideas. And therefore we will say that we are not different from the absolute if we push ourselves back absolutely, rather than to say that we come from the same source. Because you can't say that entirely diverse actions come out of the same source. But you can say that entirely diverse actions come out of a non-different source. The differentiating factor is energy itself. If we say that energy is one, we have circles, don't we? But if we say it's not two, or not plural, we haven't circumscribed it, but we're still contemplating energy. If I want to be free, I must have an idea of what free means. I must say free is the opposite of bound.
The glyph of binding is a circle. If I come to a circle,
see, that's free. Draw a circle and rub it out. Let that circle represent any concept, whatever. Any binding idea that circumscribes people's activity. See, the idea of the synagogue, the idea of the church, the idea of the Labour Party, the Communist Party. Insofar as you can apply a term, it is finite. Insofar as it is finite, it is a restriction and therefore no longer free. When we talk about perfect freedom, freedom means that the free energy domes itself. So it's equivalent to autonomy, to to self-control. So ultimately there is no freedom other than self-control. Free is non-finite. Do is finite. Freedom is the non-finite with the finite precipitated within it by itself. So if I want to be free, I must understand, I must have an idea of what to be free means. And if I want freedom, I must get self-control.
This self-control that you speak about, what was the was there any relation to this self-control when Christ was talking about being bound by the law? Can you go too far in? Or what?
Too far in self-control?
Yes, can you get to a stage where you're doing practically nothing?
If you were in control of it, obviously you could stop it at will. Take the Jainas in India, and they specialize in harmlessness, therefore they immobilize themselves. They actually stood still rather than tread on an insect. But in the process of trying to stand still, they became colossal giants of willpower. They couldn't take it too far.
Well, what about the people, for instance, that the fellows that say put one arm up and leave it there all their lives and then they can't move at all?
And then they haven't got control.
Oh, I see. They
if you hold your arm up until your joints set, you've no control of it.
And yes,
you've lost control.
It's taken an act of will to do it in the first place.
Has it? Oh, you have to be very careful to define what will is first. You see, in most of those cases, the man has been determined, certainly in the street fakirs, who are beggars, has been determined by a method of earning his living. There used to be in Manchester a gentleman with one box of matches and apparently one leg. He used to stand outside Woolworths. Actually, he had two legs, one of which was strapped up at the back. And on one occasion when he got drunk, he took it out and was severely told off by a landlord who had believed he had only one. Now, he wasn't acting freely. He was acting determined by an easy way of earning his living. The fakir who puts his arm up like this, and by so doing cultivates a reputation and some reverence in passers-by who think he's a yogi, which he isn't. All he's done is lose control. You can do certain acts. If you like to sit down with your legs crossed for 4 hours, when you come to stand up, you'll find they creak a bit and they're quite painful. And you're losing control. So at a precise point where you push an act to the stage where you can no longer determine the formal activities, you are not gaining control, you're losing it. To be intelligent about it, if you wanted to sit down for 4 hours, you should start with 4 seconds. And gradually extend the realm of your control, so that when you did stand up after a 6 hour session, you wouldn't creak. You then have control. The other way, you lose it through unintelligent action. And this again depends on the control idea that you have, to which you refer in order to determine your bodily behaviour.
Yes.
I'll have to wind up because I have to return. Okay. Bert's illustration of this is useful. Your physical body, the whole of your physical nature, is in a continuous state of inclination. It takes energy to make it sit up, energy to make it stand up, energy to make it walk, because it is made of food. And that body, which is made of food, is simply the earth picked up by energies of another order. If you refer to the physical body, it will always drag you to the ground. If you refer to something other than the physical body, you can pick the physical body up. And the choice consists in becoming clearer and clearer about the idea in your mind and the application of that idea in the material world. You cannot choose between two identical things, it's only between two different things. And one must be above and the other below. And you choose to modify the lower by reference to the higher. And that our ultimate aim is to become free, self-determinant, then there must be a clear concept of what it means to be free. Free from what? Obviously, free from the lowest end. Free from the billiard ball, isolated, egoic consciousness. Which means you must have an idea that to be out of relation is false. To be totally out of relation is to be dead. When St. Paul says there is no death, he means that the person who is believing himself totally out of relation is suffering from a misapprehension. There is no total out of relatedness. 80% of the people who go to a psychiatrist for treatment believe that they're unrelated. But their belief is false. They are related. And they act as if they were not. Once they accept the truth that they really are related, then they can begin to determine the behavior of the body and the lower levels of the emotional and ideal life by reference to higher concepts. And if ever you got the idea in your head that choice is impossible, it would become impossible for you.
Yes.
Because you would have determined with the concept of the impossibility of choice your own action. This is the concept of claiming the promise. It is stated we are free spirit. If we accept that fact and somebody comes along and says you must do as I say, whether it's in uniform or not, you defer to your inner spirit and say, I don't have to do anything any external being says, because the kingdom of heaven and my God is in heaven is within. So I refer to my depth to see whether I need do anything at all. If I am to be free, I am to be free from something. And it must be free from something other than myself. So I must have a very clear concept of what myself is. That I'm a free spiritual energy. That this spiritual energy is essentially inner. The contingent stimulus from outside has no power over me unless I confer it upon it by accepting it as valid at the level at which it comes. Not to believe in free choice is to be self-hypnotized. And auto-hypnosis is what the Marxists practice.
Well, I was having difficulty in deciding which wasn't actual choice, because I felt that whichever way you went, it could be from, say, past conditioning or memory or...
Already you conceptualize yourself as a materialist.
Yes.
If you do that, you will respond as if you were. And people who don't accept that will be superior. The Marxist believes that a man has no thought that isn't determined by material economy. And therefore his thoughts are determined by material economy. There's no such thing as generosity. Spontaneous upspringing of spirit in such a man. Because for him that's a nonsensical concept. He says, what material situation are you talking about? If you say no material situation, he thinks you're lying.
Oh, yes,
he says it's metaphysical wickedness. So that a so-called good Marxist, if you talked about actually human love or something like that, doing something for nothing, he will immediately accuse you of being metaphysical. Which to him means non-existential. You can't do something except for a material reason, because there is nothing other than matter for him.
When you mentioned accepting situations a short while ago, does this mean seeing them as they are and then deciding afterwards whether to act or not to act?
Yes. You have to see the situation, the lowest level of it, and then all the subsequent levels above it that you are sensitive enough to see. And then from the highest one, you determine the behaviour of the lowest one.
Mm. And what determines the height at which you go? The benefit you might possibly get from it, or the opportunity that there is presenting itself for development?
Well, if you say opportunity, immediately you are down on the material, external, continued stimulus again. The thing is in your will. You don't need an opportunity. Opportunity means that you've got an eye on the door that's opening.
Yes.
You see? It's your will.
You will a benefit from it.
Yes.
Yes.
It is sufficient for you to will a benefit. Your will is an energy. That energy opens doors. The port in opportunity is a door. If you open your eye, you can see the door, and you can will through the door. But if you say there is no such door, you cannot go through it. And yet another man can go through it where you say there is no door, because he doesn't accept the conceptual limitation. History is full of occasions when large numbers of men have said there is no door there, and another man has gone through. Columbus balancing the egg, you see. Just beat it on the table. It's an act of will to push through a situation when everything says there is no possibility there. But if another person says to you there is no possibility and you accept it, you have been conditioned by him. And if he's been conditioned by somebody else, which is usual, you're not even being conditioned first hand.
Is it possible the people who believe they are the materialists
are not? Well, I have taught for many years with confirmed Marxist educators, Marxist paper runners, and I have never found one who wasn't a liar. That is to say, who wasn't inconsistent and pushed to the point, admitted things that as a Marxist he should not admit. For instance, one man who's quite a figure in Germany at the moment, he admitted to being fond of his wife without a material ground. Now he can't be that. It's quite inconsistent. You see, he admitted that he would find it hard to betray his wife if she betrayed the Communist Party. Now that was inconsistent. And when he said it, it was probably because he was a bit human, he'd already come up as Marxist perch. A Marxist consistently is not human. Not in the real sense of the term. Human is a metaphysical concept. There is mineral, vegetable and animal, but there is no human. Because human implies choice. That ancient human is that higher power that inserts itself into the man, the counting device, and decides in which way the counting shall proceed.
A lot of people who call themselves Marxists are not capable of reasoning on that plane.
No, they accept passively a name given to them. On one occasion we were asked to go and debate a certain point with some Marxist student. And to me it was not surprising, but to two of the other fellows out of it was, that the leaders had not read Capital. They'd only read pamphlets. They'd not read Marxist Das Kapital. They'd not read any of the original works of Engels or Marx. They had read pamphlets about them. And they were leaders.
It's very hard work to read that capital, isn't it?
Well, it's always hard work to get down to a basic proposition. Karl Marx starts with a triangle to show what a relation is. Not many people look at that triangle and consider what a relation is. They want to skip and get through. But if they do get through those fundamentals, all they find is a series of now outdated things, discussions about social conditions that don't exist anymore. There's no revolution in England, why not? Because British workers have never been completely oppressed from above in the way that they have been in other countries. And if they're not oppressed hard enough, they can't kick back. There's nothing better than to think about this matter of choice and to realise that to be freer than one is, one must always find a higher concept than one has already got. Jesus Christ represents the incarnation of spirit. Now that's the highest concept you can possibly have. There's the absolute and the relative, the eternal and the temporal, and they're not divided. Very God, very man. The absolute has somehow condensed itself in a temporal situation. And that temporal man works absolutely, not temporally. He works immediately, not immediately by counting one thing after another. Because from his absoluteness he sees and feels the situation requirement from above. And then he inserts into the gross material situation a determinant word, which causes everything to change. And there is no higher concept possible than that the absolute should become the relative, that the eternal should become the temporal, that that which is absolutely unmanifestable should manifest. We can't go beyond that. And yet factually, as soon as we consider a subject at all, freely in any way, that is, we're not mechanically determined by the form of our education, already the absolute is breaking into the material world and incarnating itself at that point. Most people are terrified of law, of the police, of the army and so on. You go into a very poor part of Liverpool or any other big city, you'll find the appearance of a policeman at the door causes palpitation. Yes. Even in the innocent. Mm-hmm. See? Yeah. If they had another concept that the policeman is a public servant, and he's there to protect people against antisocial activity, they would say, well, he's a public servant, he's working for me, I pay his wages. Out of the rent and rates that I pay. They wouldn't feel him here. But they've been completely conditioned so that when they see the uniform, they tremble. Now, as long as they don't know the real position of the entities in the hierarchy, they must be intimidated by quite low orders of being. If they want to understand that inside everybody, the basis of authority is spirit, and that spirit is internal to every being, then every being has an internal hierarchy. And no being of a lower order outside can then come to you and tell you what to do. So your freedom consists in knowing a higher and higher concept, right up to the absolute. And if the man in blue knocks at the door, starts to walk in, you stop him and say, you're a public servant. Have you a warrant to enter this house? If he has, then he has a stated reason for having so. You see? And by understanding the law, one becomes free.
Funny thing though, well, for instance, I know about non-dualism, but how well do I know it, or how much is it included in me? I may have an idea of it, but how much about it do I really know? And to what extent can it work for me in this hierarchical sense? For instance, there may appear someone that, in spite of my knowledge of the non-dualism could press upon me. How do I go on then? It means that I may know of it, but I clearly got it worked in some peculiar way.
Well, you see, when I asked you to stand up there and incline your physical body, you knew that something was very well knit into your physical body, something you might loosely call gravity.
Yeah.
Because as soon as you incline to a certain point, you felt a definite tendency to fall.
Oh, yes.
When you can find the same definiteness in your idea, and you can call it substantiated, you're talking about knowing, without that knowing being real. Substantial. Now your nervous system and the synaptic gaps in it, the whole electric system in your body, the field dynamics of your body, have to be made to manifest at the gross material level the ideas that you have. If you have an idea and you cannot make your body respond to it, that idea is unreal to you.
Well, this is one of the things that I often puzzle about, you see, because you may be able to make your body respond to the idea up to a point, and then after that point it doesn't. Now what does that mean?
Well, it means that you've not yet substantiated certain idea levels. Take a simple example of this question of the policeman. If you found any nervousness about a policeman in yourself, it might come from childhood or from seeing films or anything. Make yourself act physically at the true level. The first policeman you see in the street, go up to that policeman and say, can you tell me the time, please? And when he's told, you say, oh, thank you very much, because I was always told if I want to know the time to ask a policeman, and keep a straight face. You see, what's your reaction? If you're afraid of being arrested, your idea isn't substantial. And it is only by forcing your physical body to act upon an idea that the idea becomes embodied, incarnate. Christ, crucifying himself, is simply taking the absolute idea and engramming it on his physical body to the final term in the crucifixion. If he'd have struck back from the crucifixion, the absolute would have remained an intellectual proposition.
That's right.
Not a gross material fact.
That's what I'm after. For instance, you're speaking about policemen. Well, you may find that you can do go up to the policeman and talk to him or without feeling any difficulty, but you may then at a later date, having done that and said to yourself, well, I don't think I've got any fear of a policeman, you may find yourself in a position where you've got two or three policemen grilling you, and then you mightn't feel that same way.
Well, again, you're deficient in ideas about the law.
Exactly. Well, I mean, there's all this. How do you know when you have got it really worked in?
Well, if you haven't got it, you do know, because you can actually function physically in it.
Because, you see, you may never really get into that situation, but it may only happen to you once in your life, and you may feel that you're all right.
You
may not be.
You must create situations. If you don't create them, and you just wait and see if they happen, then very little will happen to you.
I feel that myself, that if you don't go into it, you're not really getting at it. But what I wonder about is, for instance, this idea, an extreme trial of that nature, say for instance, a fellow finds himself in the hands of the police, he's supposed to be on a very serious charge or something like that, and they are grilling him. Well, in order to get yourself in such a situation, you may have done something particularly drastic. Now, the people normally that do those things are people that haven't gone into it consciously, they haven't given it a second thought, they're really classed as people that don't think about things, they just rush in.
Mm-hmm.
And they're the ones that seem to get into the really drastic situation.
And they're the ones who don't profit from it.
Exactly.
Because they didn't go into it deliberately.
No, well, this is the thing that I wonder about all the time. You see, I may feel that, for instance, I heard about non-dualism, and I think I know a bit about non-dualism and all the rest of it, but how do I really know it when I haven't been in such a situation since I found out about it?
You can create situations. If you want to make non-dualism real, then you must make yourself act as if it were true. If non-dualism is to be made real to you, you mustn't distinguish between the welfare of that organism and this one. So if there were an apple there, and that apple is going to be eaten, it should be a matter of indifference to you whether I eat it or you eat it. If you watch inside yourself and you find an excuse for me why you should eat it rather than I, you're not yet substantiated in non-dualism. And it's only in that kind of test that you can force the idea to incarnate. And if it doesn't incarnate, you've not completed the process. The incarnation means this, that an absolute truth has got to be put into gross material activity, and it can only be put there by an act of conscious will. It can't be put there accidentally. It can't be put there by a stupid criminal accidentally getting caught red-handed. It must be done by you watching your inclination and seeing that your inclination is not based on non-dualism, but is based on egotism. And to contradict it with the concept of the non-dual, to go against it, and to do it. It follows that if you have the power to do it, you must gain. Because the non-dual absolute will not refuse to take care of itself in you, just because you have acquired awareness of it.
Well, this is one of the things that, for instance, I feel that I do go about looking for situations a little bit, you see, and that I do attempt to reflect in the situations, and I feel that I am applying the rule of faithful in little, faithful in much, sort of thing, but what you come down to in the end is really testing it, don't you? I mean, I may feel that having been faithful in the little things, I will be faithful in the heavy trials, but until such time as I find myself in a really heavy trial, I don't know, do I?
Well, now you're talking like an empiricist. If you're 100% faithful in the most trivial thing, you know that you'll be faithful in the big thing. Because if you're 100% faithful in the tiniest thing, you can't be more than 100% in anything. And it's this whole commitment of the will. If a pin fell on the floor out of my lapel, if I had one, and you thought, oh, I can use that to pin two papers together at home, I won't mention it. That's only a pin. But if you fall down on that, you'll fall down on bigger things. If you get hold of that pin and give it to me for the right reason, you'll do the same with the big thing. The essential thing is to be 100% committed to act correctly in the little, because 100% of will is always the same. 100%. It has no contradiction inside it. And it doesn't matter whether you're being faithful about a piece of feather or about the whole world. If you're once committed wholly in the will to be faithful about the little, you necessarily will be faithful about the much. But if you have a little mental process and a reservation about whether you give the pin back, you'll find it's there when you're going to give the world back.
Yes, well,
there's no difference at all. So if you can actually accomplish that very tiniest little whole willness in returning the pin that dropped, you'll find you can do it with the big thing. Because it isn't a question of degree. Because the wholly committed will is wholly committed regardless of the size of the object.
Yes, I see that all right.
And the only thing to do is to try to find a greater number per day of opportunities for whole committal in what you're doing. To create them. If you don't make your physical body act as if the proposition were true, the proposition cannot incarnate in your gross tissue. And if it doesn't incarnate, there can be no crucifixion establishment. If it doesn't get crucified, there can be no resurrection. You can't reascend back to the absolute unless you pin yourself.
So really speaking, you're you're working for decisiveness all the time.
For whole committal. Supposing, well, supposing you have
a reservation in a whole committal, in whole committal, can there?
No.
You can't have any second thoughts about it.
None at all.
So really speaking, you're just being decisive all the time. You're not thinking about anything, are you? Just doing it, so
you're cutting away in decision.
Yes.
You're cutting from things that have nothing to do with it. They're irrelevant. Some woman asks you for a washer, a rubber thing or something, to fit on a machine. Now, you may have one, and there may be a little flaw in it. You could tell her that there's a flaw in it, and say, I'll put you this on for the time being, and I will bring you another one later. Or you could omit to tell her that there's a flaw in it and put it on and say, next time I'll charge it for another one. Now, if you do the second course, you're not substantiating your concept and you're in process of disintegrating, because there's no middle course, it's either or. And you're moving towards more and more opening of yourself to the absolute idea, or you're closing yourself. And if you close yourself, you will break. You pluralize yourself in your motive. If you want unity of will, then you must remove all the ambiguity in the will.
Yes, sir.
And it doesn't matter how tiny the thing is. If you're wholly committed in one thing, the smallest, say in supplying a screw for a washer, just one screw, value a halfpenny or something. If you can be completely a whole world in that, you can be the same thing with the whole world. Because if you watch yourself and find the slightest ambiguity in your will about that screw, you will necessarily find it in a bigger issue. And if you find that your will is pure in the little thing, apart from being startled at yourself, you will also find that you can be equally pure in a big thing. Because really, spatial dimensions, the bigness and littleness of gross material objects is irrelevant to the will. Now, I'm sorry, I must depart tonight.
Well, strange idea here of what communism is and what democracy is.